Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. This is our Mythosophia series, part 9. I'm here with Will Linney, is my co-host for this series of 12 programs. Saturday, or actually Sunday of every month. And here we are talking about myth and wisdom, delving into the depths of myth and wisdom, if you will. And today is going to be an extraordinary program. We're going to get into Greek mythology this time, more specifically, with our special guest. Also have a special announcement of mine. But Will, first of all, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
And you have a special announcement for this program.
Yeah. First I'll preface it and say that we're going to be talking about Demeter and Persephone very much today, and about memoir, which is about the life of an individual. And the story of Demeter and Persephone particularly pertains to death and the fear of death. It's one of the strong uses of the story. And I lost one of my very best friends in the last week. And his name is Brian Day, and I want to dedicate this episode to him so that he may have, in hopes that he has no fear where he is in death. So, love you, Brian.
Well, very good, very good. And my personal condolences to you and the family.
Thank you.
And I had a dear friend a few years back who passed, and I know how hard that can be sometimes. So let our listeners know that we have a Kickstarter program or project for this radio program. We are basically looking to offset the expenses of the program. So if you're interested, go to Kickstarter.com and look up Tell Me Your Story. I will have a link on my website along with the video that I created to promote what we're doing here on Tell Me Your Story to encourage those who are interested. If this resonates with you and you can do so, we would love it. There are some rewards for certain levels. We'll take any amount. But the levels, I think I placed them at $75, $150, and $500. And it starts out with a banner ad on the website for your website and the work you're doing, moves up to a commercial on the radio show, and also moves up to the possibility of being a guest here on the program to talk about the work that you're doing to make a difference in this world in regards to new paradigms for a new world. So check out quickstarter.com.
Kickstarter.com.
I beg your pardon. Kickstarter and Kickstarter are two different things.
Kickstarter, Tell Me Your Story. And also you can find the link on mythosophia.com where you can find links to previous episodes. And it'll be all over Facebook too.
I will also have a link to Mythosophia. So we're going to have it looped on the web so that people will be able to get back and forth between the two sites and the Kickstarter website. And I'm really hoping that by the 15th of October, which is the deadline, that we can raise the funds that we're asking for to continue to support this program. This is not a scare tactic like you hear on religious radio that without your support, this program will go away.
Oh, well, they say that on NPR's radios too.
Well, that's not going to happen here. But it would be helpful. It would be so graciously accepted to help to offset the expenses. So please do what you can. And with that, let's do just a brief introduction of our guest we have on the program. And she comes to us from a rather prestigious place.
Oh, geez. She's, you know, we'll do the full bio in a moment when we introduce her. But to say something a little bit about her person, you know, she is a woman, Christine Downing, who truly embodies a relationship with mythology. She has a real living relationship with stories, with these myths in her life. And her breakthrough book, Goddess, which revolutionized memoir by suggesting that you don't have to structure your life and your memoir into a single narrative all the time. She truly lives the myth and is an incredible teacher. She is actually the only living person. There are a lot of things that she's the only woman. She was the first woman to be the head of the American Academy of Religion, and she's the only living contributor to Opus Archives, where Campbell, Hillman, and Maria Gimbutas' works are housed.
Mm. Well, we're looking forward to it. So we'll go ahead and take our first break here, but you've got something else you wanted to add?
Just one more announcement. The Joseph Campbell Foundation Mythological Roundtable of Ojai, which I host with a friend, Craig Deininger, we're going to be meeting on October 19th at the Ojai Foundation, and information about that can be found on mythosophia.com and on facebook.com/OhiMyth, OJAIMYTH. And I want to give a special thanks to the Ojai Foundation for being so supportive of this show, of the roundtables and my work with them. They're an absolutely incredible institution, and I want to encourage everybody to check out their grounds and see the stuff they have going on up there.
Very exciting, and this is going to be under the Thinking Tree?
This time, it will not. This time is going to be a community conversation, is what we're going to call it, and so everyone will be invited to bring a thought about a symbol, and we'll see where it goes from there.
Interesting.
It'll be in the council house.
Wow. That sounds fascinating.
It's going to be fun. It's made to be one of the fun ones.
Well, so. I'm hoping that the weather is cooled down sufficiently by then so that we will plan on making a trip out there. And that's on when? The 19th?
October 19th. And I think it's 5 or 5:30, but that information can be found at mythosophia.com. MYTHOSOPHIA.com.
And that is a Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And this program is now on Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m.
Great.
So you can catch it or on the archives at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. I'm Richard Dugan with Will Lynn, and we're going to come back with more of Mythosophia here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay tuned.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. It's our 9th edition of Mythosophia, entertaining the myth and wisdom, if you will, of mythology with my guest host, my co-host, actually, for the last 9 months already, Will Lynn. Thank you so much for rejoining us and also for introducing our guest. And I'll need you to pull that a little closer to you there.
Sure.
So who do we have in studio with us today?
This is Christine Downing, who, well... This is actually, believe it or not, going to be a short version of her bio. Born in 1931, Dr. Christine Downing has nurtured a long career as a scholar of religion, depth psychology, feminist studies, and mythology. She was the first married woman to graduate from Swarthmore College, earning her degree in literature, and she was the first woman to earn a doctorate from Drew University, writing her dissertation on the German philosopher and religious scholar Martin Buber. In 1963, Dr. Downing began her long and renowned teaching career in the religious department of Rutgers University. In 1974, she moved to San Diego State University, where she would teach for 18 years, 10 of which she also chaired the Religious Studies Department. Also in 1974, Dr. Downing achieved yet another first, becoming the first woman president of the American Academy of Religion, delivering her presidential address on Sigmund Freud and the mythological tradition. While teaching in San Diego, she simultaneously served as a core faculty member at the California School of Professional Psychology, inspiring her to return to school for another degree, this time earning her master's in family therapy. In 1994, Dr. Downing assisted in the development of the Mythological Studies program at Pacifica Graduate Institute in Santa Barbara, where she continues as a core faculty member today, teaching Greek and Roman mythologies, Hebrew traditions, and memoir. Dr. Downing has published 9 books, including The Goddess, Mythological Images of the Feminine, Myths and Mysteries of Same-Sex Love, and Preludes, Essays on the Ludic Imagination. She has also edited 5 collections, including The Long Journey Home, Revisioning the Myth of Demeter and Persephone for Our Time, which we'll be referencing throughout our interview today. And Christine is widely acclaimed for her breadth of knowledge and her long career. And she is especially admired for her ability to blend deeply open biographical writing with rigorous scholarship. While the person is often explicitly excluded from the academic, Christine has forged a renowned scholarly career without eliminating herself from her discoveries, demonstrating the essential combination and entwinement of the historical and mythical with the personal experience to create insight and wisdom. Welcome, Chrissy.
Yeah, that's a short intro. I wonder what a long one would be.
Well, I'll take the chance to go ahead and thank Devin Daimler for preparing this this interview. She did the writing for this, and she couldn't leave any of that out.
Welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining us. I don't know if you've had an opportunity to listen to any of our other programs, whether you have or haven't. This has been fascinating for me the past 8 months, and I'm very excited about talking about the various aspects of mythology and how they play. Will and I have been talking before the program about different aspects. I even posed the question, if I was to throw topics at you with preparation, I would never just throw them at him and just say, okay, you better know.
Right.
Some people do.
Could you throw a myth at me, tell me a story that would contain that topic? And so I threw a couple of ideas out to him. So why don't we go ahead and get started? If I'm not mistaken, we're talking, one of the topics has to do with ritual, with memoirs. I mean, story is obviously the core of mythology.
Well, let me start this interview with kind of one of the most profound things that Chris Downing has done, and not just her career, but for the human literary history. She, a lot of memoirs. One of the struggles with memoir, and I'm going to ask you to talk about this, is that people tend to try, and I learned this from you, try and narrativize their own lives, and there's a tendency to try and put your life into a single narrative. You didn't do this. Why not?
Well, I think maybe partly because I wasn't setting out to write a memoir. what happened was that I had a dream, and in the dream, I said in a very loud and clear kind of way, it's time, within the dream, it's time for me to go in search of her. So I woke up from that dream being very aware that the her was in some way a kind of capital H her. And since I'm in religious studies, I knew that must mean a goddess. But I still had no clue, actually, as to what it might mean to go in search of her, or to go in search of a goddess. This is a dream I had 35 years ago now, so quite a long while. Although I think in some ways it probably continues to be the most important dream I've ever had. But anyway, as I was lying on my bed reflecting on that dream, I remembered that how when I was a child, my mother had loved to retell the stories from Greek mythology, and that one of them that she had most loved to tell was the story of Demeter and Persephone, and that really her reason for wanting to share that particular story with me was that I was her firstborn child. I was born on the first day of spring, and so she was always wanting to tell me that I was, in some ways, her Persephone, and that she loved me just as much as the goddess Demeter had ever loved her daughter, Persephone.
So your answer immediately takes us to how personal and how rich myth can be, and how, I mean, so at first I started out by wanting to point out that you actually use multiple goddesses in reflection on yourself, but it's not just multiple narratives. You're choosing goddesses to reflect on yourself. For somebody that, you know, this might seem like a really abstract idea, what value does using a lens of a deity or multiple deities provide in enriching your own experience with yourself?
Well, I think that what I discovered was that, you know, after I delved pretty deeply into that particular myth, and I know you're thinking we might return to talking about that myth later on in the program. I found in ways that continue to kind of surprise me that I found myself deeply engaged with some of those other goddess myths. For instance, a year or so later, I was dealing with the fact that divorce papers had arrived that I'd been anticipating, and it was something that I thought I'd pretty much worked through the end of that particular good relationship. But I found myself being compelled to really think through what had marriage meant to me and what had the end of marriage meant to me and so on. And somehow I was led to think that, well, the Greek goddess who's most associated with marriage. Maybe if I look deeply at her stories, I could understand that part of my life even more deeply. And so what happened was that I came to realize that Greek mythology, it's probably true of other mythology as well, provides us with such a rich panoply of feminine divine figures and gives us access to the multiple dimensions of female experience in a way that contemporary understandings of what it means to be a woman don't quite deliver.
Yeah, and I, having read the book, it really sings that beautifully. And one of the things that's on a deep level seems to be reacting to is a kind of monotheistic psyche in our culture that, you know, it's same with men. We tend to pick one type of man that is an ideal man. Why are there not? Why can't we, you know, say this is 20 really great ways to be,
yes,
you
know? Right.
And so how do you, and then there's an, Chris Downing is in Opus Archives. She's the only living contributor to Opus Archives, and that's where Joseph Campbell and Maria Gimbutas and James Hillman and many others, incredible scholars' documents are housed. And one of the, James Hillman, he gets very into the polytheistic psyche. How do you feel a connection or resonance with him on the your move to decentralize a psyche, perhaps?
You know, I do and I don't. I think I completely share with Jim Hillman a real appreciation of the way in which the soul, the psyche, has these multiple dimensions. Mm-hmm. And I think I, too, might call myself a polytheist. Hmm. But I think where I differ is that I think that, to large measure at least, Jim came to that insight in a kind of theoretical mm-hmm. kind of way. Mm-hmm. And I came to it in a more experiential kind of way. It just sort of unfolded itself for me as I was, you know, being forced in many ways to explore different aspects of my own story. And so although I agree with Jim, it's always very important to me to say, I didn't learn it from Jim, I learned it from my life.
Yeah, absolutely. And it radiates that way.
You know, the thought just occurred to me, you talk using the term polytheism, multiple gods.
Right, and goddesses.
And goddesses. Christianity certainly would advocate they're monotheistic. There's one God. And yet there's a passage in the New Testament where Jesus says, and all of you will be like God.
Right.
That
as though there
springs,
are many.
Mm-hmm. That says to me, polytheistic.
I think there are
of a
lot.
Sense.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think that actually any religious tradition has both monotheistic and polytheistic aspects mm-hmm. to it. And one of the reasons for that is that the way in which the divine manifests to us, the ways, are so multiple and diverse.
Well,
and yet there's also that in us that's compelled to unify our mm-hmm. experience. Mm-hmm. You know, so we're going to be pulled in that kind of way. And I think in that Christian tradition, particularly that passage from the Gospel of John, there's a real sense in which Jesus, as he's preparing to depart, is trying to communicate that, yes, he's the Son of God, but potentially we all are if we orient our lives in that kind of way.
It reinforces what one gentleman I interviewed many years ago concluded in his research and investigation, that the whole Christian experience is an internal process. He went through, for example, the passage that would be referred to as the rapture passage, and mm-hmm. they'll all be caught up to meet him in the air. Mm-hmm. And he researched that one word, air, that one word.
Oh, wow.
And there were two definitions in the concordance, and I did my research as well. And what I found was that one, of course, is the air that you see the clouds fly, float through, birds fly, and so forth. And then there's the air that you breathe, the same definition as God breathed the breath of life into Adam, the nostrils of Adam.
Exactly.
That was the definition that's used in that passage in the New Testament, not the other. Ergo, it's an internal rapture, if you will, not an external physical lifting up. And it changed everything for him and even for me. So when we start talking about these aspects of God, goddesshood, if you will, I wonder if there is a way for us to take a look at the various characters, or I shouldn't say characters, but persons in our lives that exhibit those various characteristics, maybe our parents, our mother or our father or a sister or brother or a close best friend or a mentor, that we would sort of, I mean, it sounds weird to anthropomorphize
or project
a person, you know, because they're already a person.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what I'm not talking about deifying them, but looking at them in that context of, boy, I would really like to be like them in that aspect.
Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, obviously we identify with aspects of people.
Yeah. But we pick and choose, too.
We do. Pick and choose. But I think I might add to that I think that anyone that we're really very closely involved with, we discovered their multiplicity.
Yeah.
So that, for instance, I could say with respect to my partner, that she's not only my partner, but there are ways in which she's a sister figure, and a mother figure and a daughter figure, and maybe even in complicated ways, a brother or father figure.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
How difficult is it when the person you love won't play the role that you need from them at that time?
Yeah.
Sometimes you want, you know, them to be your mother or them to be
exactly.
your sister. And sometimes it's time to be friend, and sometimes it's time to be
That's a good point. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know that you know, Will and I have become good friends over the last, it's almost a year, year and a half, that we started talking
it's
about this process.
It's easy to become good friends.
Well, I would agree with you there. But also that you know, when I've made a decision or two and I give him a call and we're chatting and I say, oh, yeah, I did this. He says, oh, no, that's going to come back to you, no problem. And then some.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, and we'll make reference to what I'm talking about at the end of this program. But I find it interesting, too, within the realms of entertainment, Hollywood and movies and television programs and so forth, where you will see a particular character played out.
Mm-hmm.
There's one in particular who is sort of the bad guy. I mean, if you were to do his bio, he really wouldn't be such a great guy.
What are you thinking about?
But the character... it's like the one character I'm thinking of is a character by the name of Riddick in the Chronicles of Riddick.
Right.
I like that guy. It's because he's got a strength about him and a tenacity.
And he's not just all pure light and pure white.
No,
and that's
he's
another
not.
Part of the polytheistic conversation is that when we monotheize, we also tend to dualize between the good and the bad. And in fact, you know, Zoroastrianism is argued by some people to be the first monotheism, even though it's especially dualistic, you know, but there's a good argument for it. And so I think that what we're seeing in some of these characters now, post 50s Superman, is humans that characters that express the whole range of humanity, or at least we're drawn to them, that even have darkness and shadow. And this is actually something that's a big part of the story we're going to talk about.
Well, think about The Dark Knight, Batman, the movie.
Yep,
totally. The dark side. And now, of course, they're resurrecting that in a new television series called Gotham.
Yeah, but Batman's not going to be in it. I don't want to say what I think about it.
Well, the child, Bruce Wayne is the child in this one. It's pre.
Right.
And then, of course, we went through the series of Superman films and then Spider-Man. And, of
and
course,
the characters
Marvel's
are getting darker.
They are.
Yeah.
And part of, and then, of course, I'm sitting here watching this unfold and I keep thinking about, okay, but I don't understand what the end game is with the evil stuff. The good stuff I can understand because we want a better life for ourselves.
Right.
But, you know, I was watching one program just the other night, and I'm thinking, okay, you're getting revenge against this guy. You got his wife. You're cutting her in little pieces and sending him to her piece by piece. So when she's all gone, now what?
Yeah, you know, that's a whole conversation.
Right.
I don't think that's the right way to do it either. I agree with you.
No. But again, what we do is we want to look more at the good side, but I think that we're starting to begin that process of accepting that there is the dark side, that it is a legitimate part of who and what we are.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing wrong with it. It's neither good nor bad.
Mm-hmm.
It just is. It's like when the sun comes out and you have shadows. Do you say that the shadows are bad?
Right, exactly.
Bad shadows. Go away. No.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I seek out the shadows when it's hot outside.
Well, you know, that's certainly something that was important to me when I was writing that goddess book, to look at each of those figures, be it Aphrodite, Artemis, Hera, or whatever, and recognize that for the Greeks, there was always a shadow side as well as a beneficent side. And that's what our experience of life is.
And I have this hope that, you know, we're all losing our privacy, just gone, you know, just disappearing and vanishing. And my hope is that as we lose our privacy and our shadows become increasingly exposed, that instead of becoming increasingly harsh towards the shadows, we'll give up and accept them for once.
There's a real strong move in that direction, in my opinion, and it rarely happens, but it does, when a politician is caught in his dark side, he's caught.
Mm-hmm.
There was one that I can remember, but I don't remember the gentleman's name, but he said, yeah, I did it.
Mm-hmm.
I did it, and I'm very sorry. And he did it up front at the very beginning when it came out.
Uh-huh.
And I'm real sorry, and I'm going to get help, and I'm going to move on. They never question him again.
Huh.
It's the guys who, oh, no, never.
I mean,
I remember the late 80s with the religious figures like Jimmy Swaggart. And I thought, man, you are going off the rails on this subject. And I thought of the Shakespearean phrase, me dost think thou protesteth too much. and he got caught in the very web that he was weaving to demonize anybody who was involved in that kind of lifestyle, and there he was.
So let's take that political political darkness and use it to segue into the Persephone story, and it starts with Zeus, who is king of kings around Olympus in ancient Greece, making a somewhat of a political decision. And I was actually going to ask if Chris Downing would be willing to just tell us the story of Persephone and maybe start.
I don't get, though, how the story starts with Zeus.
Oh, well, maybe not starts with Zeus, but I just mean in that she's abducted, there had to have been a decision to give her away. And maybe that's, tell me how that's not the start of the story, because you probably have a much more beautiful vision of starting somewhere better.
But I'm sorry. I guess I would start with the fact that here's a mother and a daughter, Demeter and Persephone, who are deeply, deeply devoted to one another, you know, and the love flows back and forth between them. And as I always say, that makes a beautiful image, but it doesn't make a story. So if there's going to be a story, something's going to have to break into that relationship. And the way in which the story unfolds is that one day Persephone's, you know, out in a meadow playing with her girlfriends, and all of a sudden the dark god of the underworld comes and abducts her, pulls her absolutely away from everything she's ever known, which until now has been completely the world of women, right? And suddenly she has an experience of the reality of the male world, and it's really frightening to her. You're right. We later learn that this dark god of the underworld had, way before that, gone up to Persephone's father, whom she has no awareness of at all, and asked for permission to marry his daughter. And Zeus says, sure, you're an okay. You'd be an okay bridegroom, right? So Zeus does play a role in this story.
And, you know, maybe it looks a little bit like, you know, kings making those political arrangements with their daughters. It at least smells like that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, and of course, in that particular world, in that Greek world, that was the typical marriage pattern, that fathers arranged the marriages of their daughters, and the daughters didn't have any say-so, nor did the mothers, actually.
So can you, would you be willing to walk it, build your momentum? I won't interrupt you. And could you tell us the story after she gets taken?
Well, I need to back up one step before she gets taken, which is that in the story, what happens is that she notices at the edge of the meadow that there's an especially beautiful flower, a narcissus, that she absolutely has to have for her bouquet, right?
And everybody's looking at it even, right? Even the gods and goddesses think
it's stunning, right? And it turns out it's been planted there by her grandmother. And so we get a hint that that plant has been planted there on purpose to attract Persephone's attention. And so she reaches out and plucks it. And what happens is that where the bulb had been is the beginning of this hole out of which Hades, the dark god of the underworld, emerges. But I think it's really important that it's the narcissus, which is a flower that is associated with the self. And so part of my way of understanding this story is that there's at least a part of Persephone that kind of knows that it's time for her to move away from mother.
Doesn't she even seize it with budding eyes?
Yes.
As though she's ready.
Yes. Yeah. 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 Very much so. So, yes, it's an abduction, but it's also in a kind of inchoate, maybe only pre-conscious kind of way, Persephone is inviting what happens to her. She needs it.
And as we'll get there, she certainly owns it in the end.
Yes. Yeah.
So after she's abducted, how does her mother react?
Well, her mother, of course, is absolutely devastated. In what we might even call a kind of narcissistic way. I mean, the mother is so identified with being mother that now that she doesn't have a daughter, she's kind of lost herself as well as her daughter. But she is absolutely determined that one way or another, she is going to get this daughter.
With mama strength.
With mama strength, right, yeah.
And it's a real, and the story is a precedes really kind of leaves Persephone in the dark and follows Demeter.
It does. And the story, you know, in the most well-known version is called the Hymn to Demeter.
Mm-hmm.
And it really does focus on Demeter's experience. And we get very little clue to what Persephone's experience is. And even at the end of the story, when Demeter, through various stratagems and so on, has indeed succeeded in getting her daughter back. And, you know, they're rejoicing in that reunion, mm-hmm. and all of that. And Demeter, at great length, tells her daughter how awful this whole separation has been for
mm-hmm.
her.
Mm-hmm.
She eventually turns to her daughter and says, "And Persephone, well, and how was it for you?" And Persephone, you know, gets like three sentences.
That wasn't the first question either, right?
No. Hmm. And Persephone gets like three sentences into the story, and then her mother interrupts her.
Hmm.
And we never do get to hear Persephone's version of what it had been like.
Now, that's a life lesson. The things we would have learned if we didn't interrupt. Oh, wow. Maybe the secrets of Eleusis, even.
Yeah.
Wow.
Brings to mind the phrase, "It is best to be thought a fool than open thy mouth and remove all doubt." And a fool is one who doesn't listen.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So on this, she also, on this journey, almost projects her own child into another child. How do you tie what happens with Demophoon into the bigger narrative with Persephone?
Okay. Well, that story is that Demeter, during these years devoted to rage and grief,
mm-hmm.
Ends up for a while serving as a dry nurse to a baby who has just recently been born to a local queen. And she has... maybe the simpler way to do this is to say that one night the queen just can't resist going back to the nursery and taking one last peek at her beloved mm-hmm. little newborn son. And she's horrified as she walks in the room to see that this dry nurse that she's hired, that of course she has no clue that it's actually Demeter, is holding her precious little baby in the fire. And so she kind of screams, "What the hell are you doing
yeah.
with my child?"
Uh-huh.
And Demeter, suddenly this old dry nurse, you know, gets bigger and bigger and younger and more beautiful and is clearly a goddess, and protests in rage that you have prevented me from making your baby immortal. And, you know, we get a sense.
But does she protest because she sees it as her baby kind of a little bit?
Well, in a way. I mean, I think that in a way she has kind of substituted
yeah.
this baby. But, you know, one of the things she doesn't realize is that she has abducted Metaneira's baby in a way that's not all that different from the way in which her daughter had been abducted from her. Mm. She doesn't even get the parallel, right?
took me several times with the story, and right now, thanks.
Yeah. But the other thing is that she also still hasn't gotten the fact that life is change.
Mm-hmm.
And so she wants to immortalize.
With the symbol of change, fire.
Right.
That's funny.
Yeah, that's great.
Huh.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is just a pet interest that I just tangent ask you this question. So I came across the stories of the Narts in the Caucasus, and they have a story of putting a boy in flames or removing him from a fire.
Uh-huh.
And it's very interesting because it ties together elements not just of Demeter but also of Achilles. So what happens is the conception is when the metallurgist falls for the matron, and he ends up ejaculating on a rock, much like the birth of Erichthonius with Hephaestus, you know, pursuing.
Right.
So what happens is this rock becomes impregnated. 9 months later, the rock, and this is a virgin birth story, obviously, too.
Uh-huh.
9 months later, the rock gives birth to a sun bright child. And then the metallurgist takes the child with his tongs and puts him in the water, puts him in the fire, puts him in just like a metal.
Yeah.
And his vulnerable spot is where he was held by the tongs on his thighs. And there is reason to believe that these could be based on even older stories than some of the Greek stories. Of course, that will be a long time before that argument's settled. But I am so interested in whether this old archaic immortalization is a tie-in to some maybe metallurgical kind of symbolism or something like that. Have you ever felt that way?
Well, I don't know if I've ever thought it in quite that way, but it definitely is connected to metallurgy and to the whole traditions about Hephaistus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then that
and that connects with alchemy. And you, even better than I, could go on and on and on, spinning out all these different parallels and relationships.
Well, while we're there, I'll ask, too. So connecting to Hephaistus, we learned a bit about, you know, a bit that you can learn about the Eleusinian mysteries in your class, and we're going to talk about that some more now in a bit. But there are also a male mystery cult that gets very little exposure in conversation, that is the Cabiroi. And there is an old story that Carinae points to that I think Pausanias writes about it, so it's not old writing.
Right.
That's saying that that the Cabiroi actually had an interaction with, so that Prometheus and Hephaestus had an interaction with Demeter, as though their mysteries actually had an entanglement with the mysteries of the feminine mysteries, and it gets way below the line of knowledge and certainty. But I'm just so interested, if you, with your infinitely more words in your head on this topic and in this range, have you ever come across dances between the male and the female mystery cult?
Not with that particular mystery cult.
Okay.
There's a lot of intersection beginning pretty late 5th, early 4th century, between Eleusinian mysteries and Orphic mysteries, and a tie to, in other words, to Dionysian mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never heard of that, you know, that particular relationship. But, and I think maybe this is where you're leading, it definitely is true that the Eleusinian mysteries, which are dedicated to the two goddesses, Demeter and Persephone, were, at least by the 5th century, mysteries that were open not just to women, but were open to men as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a bringing together of, you know, male and female kinds of perspectives and concerns,
right,
and so on.
There. And the story seems very much to do with that coupling of male and female, and seemingly, obviously, about the fertility of the fields, which is the male and female combination. And so the imagination, an imagination like mine at least, wants to look for a combination,
right,
of the cult with the male-female secret interactions. But gosh, I bet that. Anyway, so.
But I think it's important that in some ways maybe they weren't combined, because I do think it's important that there be male mysteries and there be female mysteries.
I couldn't agree with you more. Why do you think that? I want to let people hear you say more why you think that's true.
Well, because I think that there are things that women can really only share with women, and that helps them understand themselves more deeply, and maybe then prepares them when they move then back out of that container to relate better with men as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
and I think maybe even particularly for men to really discover that men can connect with one another in spiritual ways, in imaginal ways, in affectional ways, and so on, that they don't have to relate to one another just in external ways.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a big deal.
Yeah, I really do too. And I think it's nice, the idea of these mysteries, or one of the great things they offer, is just simply a space for this consideration, for these interactions,
right,
for these relationships. And I've heard you mention in your Judaism class that religion can start with the human. It can start with the importance of human relationships as opposed to just all the grandiose intentions of religion. And just getting together with people that can go deep into your own thoughts with you. Sangha.
Yeah.
Let's go a little bit into the Eleusinian mysteries. This is a great opportunity to talk about how myth and ritual can actually be highly entangled.
It's
an incredible example. And since you also offer such a good example of enriching your own life with a myth and turning your own life into a near ritual, the overlap of the mediums of a story is one of the big topics, ongoing topics of our conversation. Mm-hmm. Could you speak a little bit to the rituals that happened in Eleusis that went with these stories?
Okay. Well, the Eleusinian Mysteries are a ritual that takes place in the fall over a mm-hmm. period of 5 or 6 days. And it initially begins in Athens as a procession, mm-hmm. and various things happen, you mm-hmm. know, along mm-hmm. the way as the initiates take this path that leads from Athens to this still relatively small village that lies probably about 15 miles southeast of the southwest, actually, of Athens. But the big mystery, in a way, is exactly what happens when they actually arrive at Eleusis and spend a night mm-hmm. Together in a kind of subterranean chamber that's real different from any other Greek temple that we know about.
And do you think that chamber could be even used? It could have been used for far longer than maybe even the ritual site for this purpose, you think? Even
well,
more archaic?
I don't know. Partly because the chamber itself is so large that I don't think it would have predated this becoming, you know, a pretty major ritual.
It was a man-made
ritual.
Chamber down there. Yeah, gotcha.
Definitely a man-made chamber. And I think that the most important thing to say about them is really that what they offered initiates was freedom from the fear of death. Mm-hmm. So something that is a big deal in human experience always. And what's amazing about this ritual is that, you know, people participated in it over centuries. Mm-hmm. And we have testimony after testimony that this ritual delivered what it promised.
You are true. I was going to prove it. Their testimonies are there, and then they extend over a long period of time.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this fear of death that they deal with, and taking us back to the story, this is a story of Persephone going to the underworld and mm-hmm. coming back. So this is a coming-of-age story. This is a marriage story. This is a rape story. And this is also a death story, it would seem, or at least it is designed to mime what that story would be.
Yeah. Well, I think part of what lies behind the Eleusinian Mysteries, mm-hmm. and I think it's very important that they are dedicated to the two goddesses, dedicated to Persephone, who becomes, and we didn't have a chance to say this earlier, who eventually becomes the goddess of the underworld, mm-hmm. the goddess of the world of the dead. Mm-hmm. And in every other, you know, myth that the Greeks tell, aside from the hymn to Demeter, Persephone's always there. I mean, that's who she really most importantly is, goddess of the world of the dead.
And even her name implies that, you've mentioned.
Yeah, it relates to death mm-hmm. and somehow or other. We're not mm-hmm. exactly sure how. But it's dedicated to the two goddesses because in the part of the story that we've alluded to so far, Demeter herself is very clearly fearful about what's happening to Persephone in the world of the dead and so mm-hmm. on. She has a very negative, fearful understanding of mm-hmm. death. And it seems as though maybe that reunion of theirs, the conversation they have when they first get together, actually continues beyond what the hymn includes.
Right.
And eventually Demeter really gets around to saying, and Persephone, what was it like for you? And Persephone probably answered, well, Mom, it wasn't all that scary. In fact, it's a very rich world down there.
The things that we need to hear about death.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And so Demeter, when we get to this ritual tradition, comes to be seen as the first initiate, the one who, through kind of learning from Persephone what being in the world of the dead is really like, mm-hmm. Is freed from her own fear of it, and so becomes a kind of sign to all of us that maybe it's not all that scary after all.
Well, I think about it far too much, and it's I certainly hope not. And one of the things that's so beautiful about what you just described is that Persephone is now teaching her mother after she's,
exactly.
You know, so there's this beautiful reflection. And you even point out, too, that Rhea joins them, who's the mother of Demeter. So in this moment, and Hecate's there, too, but in this moment, you have the daughter, mother, grandmother, the full generational. And so I've heard it said that actually one of the things that takes away part of the fear of death in this story is a recognition of the continuity of life that the three of them represent.
Yeah.
Of course, that doesn't make me feel better about the death part, but I do think it's that is definitely a beautiful part of the story, and it blossoms into the perpetuation of. Well, I wonder about this myself, but the perpetuation of soul in the field. You know, the fields. There must have been such an important relationship with the grain fields that they related to Demeter. Those grain fields must have played a huge role in the imagination of this story and of the mysteries. And so I wonder what they projected into those fields. And sometimes I think it's the souls of their people.
Yeah, I think it could be that. You know, I think that, you know, clearly the life of the grain is a life of death, of death.
Mm-hmm.
And then of renewal of life, but mm-hmm. not of the same life.
Right. See,
and I think that's one of the things that is important, that probably we have no way of knowing for sure
mm-hmm.
What the secret of the mysteries was, because mm-hmm. one of the things that...
Because you won't tell us. Just kidding.
I won't tell you because I don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing, what the Greeks meant by a mystery religion was a religion where people swore to keep secrets,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so mm-hmm. even though that those mysteries were celebrated over those centuries and centuries, people did keep
respect
the secret,
them, yeah.
right? But I do think yeah. that one of the, probably what that ritual provided was not a promise of some kind of individual immortality, which may be what Christianity offers
right.
us, but rather more a way of really communicating to us that being part of the ongoingness of life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This grandmother, mother, daughter, and mm-hmm. then in turn the daughter becomes a mother
right.
and all of that. That real participation in the ongoingness of life
mm-hmm.
frees us from being so attached to
from an
our
egoistic
individual
yeah.
Egoic existence. Yeah.
Because I when I confront my own fear of death, it is I do recognize that the fear is only relevant from the point of view of my ego.
Right.
And now a lot of people use drugs to destroy their egos, and some people argue that that's going on in these stories. I know you have a point of view on that. What's your take on whether or not this is going on?
Well, you know, that suggestion that maybe during that night that they spent in the subterranean chapter that the initiates ingested a drink that had... you know, some psychedelic kind of power attached to it. That was put forward in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I think it was put forward at a time when we all sort of, or many
that.
Of us, no, sort of thought the way to access that kind of experience was through drugs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that since then, anyone who's ever been to a rock concert
mm-hmm.
knows, well, that's probably not a good example because there's usually a lot of drugs at a rock concert. But anyone, I mean, I think a lot of us have come to recognize that when you bring together darkness
mm-hmm.
and drums beating
mm-hmm.
And a whole crowd of people all expecting a big deal kind of experience,
mm-hmm.
that there's a real likelihood
yeah.
that you'll have the experience you think you're going to have,
hmm.
and you don't really need drugs to access it.
And
that's
they've even shown people in sensory deprivation chambers will begin to hallucinate in all sensory ranges. And I did read, Carigné makes the argument that even the use of honeymead and wine with Dionysus was compensating for a loss of connectivity to what they're trying to connect with.
Mm-hmm.
A more natural connection before, you know, that the drugs and the alcohol, even in the beginning, were compensatory.
Mm-hmm.
I find it interesting because this is a subject that we cover a lot on the program. It's one that I used the term, it's near and dear to my heart because it fascinates me to no end. I'm not interested in necessarily causing the process to happen before its time.
Yeah.
But I'm very curious as when somebody that I who's famous or someone that I know has passed on, I'm very curious as to what's going on. What are they doing? What are they feeling, seeing, tasting, smelling, experiencing, and wanting to come back and share that with others? And now in some of my interviews of late, there's sufficient scientific evidence that is now beginning to come forth to verify through, and again, this is not my information, uh-huh. this is just what others are saying, through quantum physics and scientific investigation. To me, it's just fascinating. The analogy that I use is I ask someone, so you've been alive for X number of years. Let's say you got your license at the age of 16. How many cars have you driven? How many cars have you gone through in your life? And some will say two or three or four. I said, so, and the difference between that and a human life is that you're doing the same thing. All you're doing is changing vehicles. The essence of who you are is still the same. Now you're moving on to the next one. I don't have that fear that, like, what you're talking about.
Yeah, sometimes
Will.
I do. I'm very connected to myself, and I'm scared of losing him.
Yeah, and I can understand that.
But I also recognize it's a him. That's not all totally me.
Well, and who is that him?
Jeez. I think about that after the show.
Well, that's one of the aspects, too, I wanted to touch upon. It sounds, because you've been talking an awful lot about Greek mythology. Right. And of course, at the beginning of the program, beginning of the segment, you mentioned that there are so many other myths from other corners of the globe. What was it about Greek mythology that drew you in?
Well, I think in a lot of ways it was my mother. And, from the time that I was very, very little, her sharing with me particularly those stories that she in turn had grown up with and the Grimm's fairy tales. Hmm. So I've known these stories all my life, whereas the mythologies of other traditions I've learned along the way. It's true that when I was, maybe 9 or 10, I got fascinated with Egyptian mythology. So that's the other mythology that I have a kind of almost lifelong connection with. Whereas other traditions, including even Native American traditions, I know through books mostly that I encountered in my adult life. Mm-hmm. So I have a different relationship to them. Mm.
And I think that's a really important point in the context of studying multiple religions and mythologies, and for anybody listening, because if you were raised in Christianity, there's value in whatever you were raised in, because it's part of your inner structure. I've not come across any religious or mythological tradition that doesn't offer valuable opportunities of projection and inner relationship. So whatever the native tradition is deeply important, even if eventually you, in some level, you deeply disagree with it or something like that. The Dalai Lama says that every religion is like a different cure for a different spiritual problem, and so part of what I do is seek cures for my many problems in many places. But there is definitely a strong importance to the stuff that is embedded in us, because it's through that that we can reflect. And actually, this sets up a good question for you. Did you live this myth, or was it the other way around?
I don't know. I don't know which which that is. Yeah.
Well, that's the best answer.
Yeah, I guess.
In the last 10 years, I've become extremely introspective. At the age of 54, I don't know whether it's because of the fact that I've reached that level or because of the experiences that I've had and the interviews, the people that I've spoken with, yourself and others. And one of the things that I'm curious about is in mythology, in terms of the dramas that take place, I know that a lot of people are still blaming the outside world for what ails them. And I went through a period of time only a few years back where I was having these bouts of frustration and anger over the outside world, my blood pressure would go up, and they did all the tests and everything and telling me I had high blood pressure, but we can't find the cause. And I said, I know the cause. But now I've gotten to a place a few years later where I'm beginning to understand that it's me. It's all about me. So I'm curious as to whether or not mythology addresses that in this kind of context.
Or at least gives you tools for that.
Or maybe gives you tools to begin to understand that it's not these other characters out there. It's you.
Yeah. Well, I think what one of the things that mythology does with its particular stories, it provides us with particular patterns of life. And in those patterns, on the surface, as you're suggesting, some of the things seem to happen because of outer causes, and some of the things are more inner caused or relate to inner appropriation of outer events and so on. Mm-hmm. But what the story patterns give us is a sense that it makes a whole and that you can't really separate out what in your life you receive and experience from outside and what in your life you experience from inside. It's all one package.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And in terms of wanting to then, of course, impart that to others, wanting to get, so to speak, the rest of the world to understand that concept, that it ain't them versus you, it's you versus you, which generates a whole lot of other stuff, but very valuable. And I often wonder if there comes a point in our life, hopefully it is not at death or the transition to the next world, where we begin to we finally understand, oh, yeah, I'd like to be able to live in that state for 10 or 15 or 20 years.
And so this,
I'm not sure I would.
Into the
introversion. And I've got a lot of, I get, you know, 3 decades on you. But I don't want to get it all together.
You want to have something left for the next world in terms of...
Well, no, not the next world, but next year or next week.
You know, Dennis Slattery,
whatever,
the first guest on this show, said something to me that a mentor of his said to him a long time ago, and it was so good. He said, because I'm a little fast mover sometimes, he said, may you not get there till the end. And, you know, I tell myself that all the time. It's true, because there's value in getting there at the end. To rush in there all the time.
And then there's also the other thought that, what was it? I remember early in my Christian radio days, I used to think about this, how every time you got, let's say, closer to God, you never got to God. Okay?
Right.
But this was the equation. You always moved one half the distance and one half the distance, which means you never get there. No matter how close you get, you never actually get there because it's always one half of whatever the distance is. No matter how small
that's
the
calculus.
Distance.
Calculus.
Okay.
Right.
So I didn't take calculus, so I wouldn't have known that. But I find that so fascinating that, you know, for my concept, you never, like you say, may you not get there till the end. But if there is a continuation of life, and I don't know whether mythology addresses the issue of reincarnation. Many, many people believe in it.
Well, some mythologies do.
And so you never really have an end.
Yeah.
Right. But, you know, I would say something actually slightly different maybe about this relationship to the divine, which is rather than our getting closer and closer but never quite making it, I think in my own experience I'd probably say more – we have moments when we have it, but they're
Satori
moments.
Satori moments.
Yeah, Satori moments.
Like in the Zen Buddhist tradition, they don't believe enlightenment is something you just get to and then have. It's like you have these moments of Satori. And one of the things I wanted to make sure we dwelled on for a moment before we move towards conclusion, and I know we need to. We're talking about deepening of life experience, and this is a story of where Persephone goes into the depths.
Yes.
So at what level does this story represent just simply the deepening of the soul and an exploration into the depths? And at what level is this, is how does this story encourage us or show us really how to do that and where it goes?
I don't know that it shows us how to do it or whatever, but I think it shows us that these things happen. Mm. You know, I do think that, you know, part of, you know, when I was dealing with that dream, mm-hmm. and turning to Persephone as an adult woman, mm-hmm. of my myself rather than as my mother's beloved daughter and so on, mm-hmm. the part of Persephone that came to mean most to me was actually her being goddess of the underworld.
Mm.
And that what that signified to me is that the kinds of experiences that happen that are maybe initially most frightening or disconcerting or whatever, that pull, mm-hmm. us down into the depths,
mm-hmm.
Are experiences that are very rich,
mm.
indeed, that they're sacred.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and if you have a goddess of the underworld, that means it's a sacred place to be.
Mm-hmm. And let's be honest, I would be way more comforted by meeting Persephone down there than Hades. I hope motherly arms greet me.
Yeah.
So let's do your conclusory questions.
As we wrap up every interview, almost every interview, I have three basic questions.
Mm-hmm.
The first, and you go by Christine, Christy,
all kinds of things,
and
I have as many names as, you know, all this multiplicity we've been talking.
Just like all the other goddesses.
And it's Christine Downing.
Yeah.
Who is Christine Downing?
I have no answer to that. Will gave his answer.
It was a long one,
long introduction. I'm just whoever I am at the moment. Yeah.
Hmm. Okay. And what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
I think this is what every teacher says. I want my students to discover what they're most drawn to, what gives them life, what motivates them, what makes them happy, what makes them discontent, just to go their own way and feel that it's a worthwhile way to go.
Hmm. And who inspires you?
Well, I don't know. Well, I guess they still inspire me, but in a sense. But I think that it's dead white men.
I'm going to ask for an explanation of that.
And, you know, they are the teachers whom I met through their books when I was really in my 20s.
Hmm.
Carl Jung, Martin Buber, and Sigmund Freud.
And I have the Buber
very,
book.
Very, very interesting. I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program today. It's been a great hour.
It was fun.
And we hope that we can talk to you again in the near future further about this subject. And I'm hoping that my education by the end of this first year of these 12 lessons will take. And because I feel as though I really missed out on an awful lot. I wasn't taught that I can recall about Greek or Roman mythology or what have you. I remember watching Rocky and Bullwinkle and seeing the fractured fairy tales,
right.
those
uh-huh.
myths and stories and the morals to the stories. But again, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks,
thank you.
Chrissy.
And Will, thank you. Part 9 of our 12-part series for 2014 coming to a close. Who are we looking for, or what kinds of topics are we looking for in the coming weeks, coming months?
Well, we've set up interviews, and I don't know which one will be next, with John Rotz, who's the head of the Global Alliance of Transformative Entertainment, and with Steven Eisenstadt, who is the founder of Pacifica.
Looking forward to those.
Mm-hmm.
Will, thanks again. I'm Richard Dugan, and I thank you for joining us here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. This is Mythosophia, exploring the depths of myth and wisdom here on Tell Me Your Story.